Hello and welcome back to Debt Wired, where we break down everything debt related with expert insights. I'm your host, Melina Halkia, and today we're unpacking the current environment of liability management exercises. What's the outlook for LMEs in this volatile market, and how are lenders and sponsors adapting? To help us break it all down, I want to bring in Justin Lee. He's the co-head of the banking and finance practice at Weil, Gotchall & Manges, and the global head of liability management and strategic capital solutions. Justin, great to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. Gorgeous day out to be on a podcast.
It really is, and a very interesting day to talk about the markets. So let's start with the LME landscape. Equity and credit markets are rallying today on the China-US tariff deal. Has this changed the sentiment for LMEs recently?
LMEs are a long-term project. What you're typically doing on the company side is you're addressing an issue, right? And that issue may be an upcoming maturity, it may be capturing discount, it may be getting some new money, but it's not something that you would look at the markets and decide one day or another whether you're going to go and launch an LME transaction. It's more so addressing the long-term considerations for the company. So I would say we certainly look at the market, it certainly informs our views, and it may inform whether we're getting more calls or less calls, but it doesn't change day to day.
And I know obviously with the tariff announcements, it's been an uncertain market environment. Are you getting more or less calls? Like, are companies delaying pursuing a restructuring in and out of court when so much is unknown given trade policy and market?
I think that one thing that companies dislike the most is uncertainty. So as sponsors and companies figure out their next moves, they need to plan for the long term. They can't be planning week by week or depending on what the markets are doing or what uncertainties there might be. So what they're doing is thinking, what does my business plan look like? What are the externalities that are going to affect my business plan? And how long do I think that those last for or don't last for? And then planning ahead, for example, with LMEs, oftentimes we're trying to get more runway to effectuate on the business plan. So delivering on that business plan is going to be one thing. And the other part will be, how do I get from here to there, getting myself more time, more money, or capturing discount?
Which part of the process are you getting more deals on the pipeline?
It's very interesting because I would say that the liability management in general has been around for quite some time. We were very involved at the outset. And what we've seen is the receptivity for LME and to having those conversations and understanding what tools are at a sponsor's disposal. There's a wider audience for it than there's ever been. I was in London last week meeting with some of my colleagues and some of our London side sponsor clients. And certainly it has not caught on as much in Europe, but it is something that folks are looking to the US to see what may be coming their way, figuring out what the differences are between those markets and what might resonate in a European market and what might not. And then also just kind of reading the tea leaves as to what might be coming their way.
I know that last year was a very active year for LMEs. What's your outlook for the rest of 2025?
I'm new to the liability management, heading up the practice at Weil. And I would say that the amount of inbound calls and meetings that we've had is exponential. I think that there are, watch lists amongst the financial advisors that are growing by the day. And there's certainly a lot of appetite for even opportunistic transactions. So it's not always waiting until there's an issue that needs to be addressed, but thinking proactively about the flexibility and credit documentation, looking at who the stakeholders are and how we might drive the best outcome for our clients. I would say that 2024 was the busiest year for LME, but I would say that 2025 is shaking up to be about as busy, if not busier.
When you're saying these deals are increasing, has that been in the past couple of months? Is it because of the tariff policy announcements?
I don't think so necessarily. I think a lot of it has to do with just looking at the optionality. And I think that as more sponsors engage in these transactions, the transactions are, somewhat consensual. They're driving good outcomes for the sponsor and for the company. So they're getting new money in, they're capturing discount, they're kicking out maturities. When you're looking at your toolkit of what you might be able to do to manage your capital stack, it's certainly an opportunity. And it's an opportunity that folks are taking advantage of. Some of the meetings, of course, will go a deep dive of their documents, give them a whole lay of the land, and they may say, it doesn't make sense for me at this point for whatever reason, right? But hearing that receptivity and hearing that the conversation around what the objectives are and how we might accomplish those, I think that there's definitely an audience for that, and there's definitely a level of receptivity that we haven't seen before.
Are there any specific types of LMEs that you see more lately?
One thing we've been seeing a lot of is the non-pro rata deals. The non-pro rata deals that are being done on a decently consensual basis, so typically getting 95, 97% plus participation. And those are driven by not really like in-group, out-group, but just different tiers of participation. So finding a way to bring along as many of the existing lenders as possible into the new pro forma structure. We've been seeing a lot of that. Obviously, there's always the specter of deal-aways and third-party capital coming in to show up at the party and have a different proposal. We've loved to see the level of engagement that we've gotten from lenders, because I think lenders now, they're keen to LME. They understand that something may be coming down the pike. And oftentimes they're actually calling or they're organizing because they have a proposed solution for whatever the issue might be.
We've been hearing a lot about dealaways lately. They're still happening, but they're becoming more expensive. Is that the case?
Absolutely. I think that one of the biggest issues with dealaways is that if you have an existing lender group, the lender group can deliver on changes to your credit documentation, right? Because they're the required lenders and they can go in and change things, change baskets, change permissions, change the restrictions under the credit agreement. With a pure dealaway, you are transacting with someone who is potentially not in the existing capital stack. You are constrained by what your credit documentation says or doesn't say, and then you are engaging in transactions. So I think the professionals that we work with in the dealaway market are somewhat frustrated that they put in the time, effort, and you know, manpower, woman power to figure out solutions and craft creative things, and then feel as though you're just going to go back to the existing group and you're going to do something with them, and you used me as kind of like the credible threat.
Are lenders open to advancing capital absent a broader LME?
I don't think that lenders are closed off from advancing capital. I think there has to be some kind of a quid pro quo. So if you look at the most vanilla LME, just in the mend and extend, that's just kicking out maturities, right? If you are looking at a more creative one where you're doing something that involves new money, super senior money, some kind of exchange, there's going to be more of a trade-off as to what lenders are expecting. So lenders are going to require changes to the documents, I think, in all scenarios. The one item that we are always counseling our clients about is just the level of tightening that you're going to experience in the context of an LME. Because you do one LME, your pro forma credit agreement is probably going to be meaningfully tighter. It's going to be more focused on what the use cases are. It's going to be very LME proof in that you're going to get one bite at the apple and one opportunity to make a play for right-sizing the capital stack, for kicking out maturity, for getting some new money. And a lot of the tools in the toolkit are then going to be unavailable to you in the future. So people do really have to think through what's the current circumstances, who are the current stakeholders, and how do I drive value, and is now the right time, or should I actually be pausing for something that, you know, is down the pike?
And I want to talk a little bit about what your practice involves. Where in the capital structure do you work on LMEs?
Sure. So the long story short is we work across the capital structure. So what we'll do as an initial matter is we'll get a call from a client. We'll look at who the various stakeholders are. So say there's an ABL, a first lien term loan, secured notes, unsecured notes, and preferred equity. We have to think of the considerations for all of those. So typically what we'll be doing is we'll be mapping out the various documentation where there are linkages and where things are similar and where there's divergences and where you might be able to pull apart the group or to utilize flexibility. The ideal scenario would be that you can do things without talking to anyone, right? And a lot of the sponsor documents are going to have a ton of flexibility to move things around, to drop down assets, to up tier, to do creative things, right? And if you can do that, then you can start driving through who do I approach and when? And what we're doing is we're really doing game theory on who should we be talking to at what point in the transaction and how do we drive value while trying to find solutions that don't require everyone to be on board, right? If you came and said, if everyone gives me consent, I can do XYZ, that's great, but that doesn't get you very far. You really need to be able to find out where the pressure points are and to be able to drive those negotiations in a way that unfolds and allows you to unlock value from each of the creditor groups.
And you mentioned the flexibility that sponsors have in these situations. I know you've worked on some major deals for companies like Clarios and Hertz, which we've been following very closely. In the current market environment, do sponsors still have that flexibility and that leverage to get these provisions into the final docs?
Yes. I think that as a general matter, the syndicated market is still very active. I think that for top tier sponsors, they are still able to drive terms, especially on a new LBO. Are there going to be concessions along the way? LME blockers, you know, constraints on what people can do? Absolutely. Are those going to close off all of the flexibility? Absolutely not, right? You're going to have large baskets. You're going to have reclassification provisions. You're going to have permissions that even setting aside any LME blockers are going to allow you to do lots of creative transactions under your documentation. And I think that there has been some reaction to the market. The reaction to the market is typically in the vein of, I'm going to block the latest couple of things that have happened. But they're blocked in a way that there may be exceptions, there may be other baskets that are available, there may be structuring that allows you to accomplish the same goal in a different way. It's a little bit, I think some folks have referred to it as a little bit of whack-a-mole. You're not able to close off all of the flexibility, because if we were going to close off all the flexibility, we'd have very short credit agreements. They'd be very boring and they would take a lot less time to analyze. Here, you actually do have, you know, meaningful business needs for baskets and for capacity and for flexibility. And I think sponsors have continued and will continue to be able to garner that flexibility in their documents. If the syndicated market, you know, shut down or there was meaningful pushback from creditors, then it's possible to swing back the other way. But in the context of, for example, like, you know, three times oversubscribed deals, you're not going to be able to win a lot of those dock points. It's going to be kind of a, you know, must-have situation.
So you're not seeing any big shift in how effective a lender pushback is in these situations, right? It's still very much focused on the flexibility for the sponsor.
I think in the context of oversubscribed deals, absolutely. If you have a trickier credit and, you know, it's not going to fly off the shelves, it's going to be a little bit harder of a story. I think that they're, you know, the underwriter in the syndicated market or direct lender is going to be a lot more focused on tightening those up and making sure that they have all of the protections that they would need to in the syndicated context to be able to bring it to the market and get investors interested in it. And then in the direct lender market, just to protect themselves. The interesting thing that you see in the syndicated market versus direct lender market is most of our clients are approaching both of those markets at the same time, especially for, you know, an LBO, just to see what they can get in each of those markets. And there's going to be pluses and minuses for both. But I think that the rules of competition, the more demand there is for that deal, the better the terms are going to be for the sponsor, because folks are not looking to miss out based on some doc terms.
Are you seeing a preference for direct lending deals over syndicated markets?
I think it really ebbs and flows. And I think that the banks are certainly looking to get more of their market share back, and that you've seen a lot of partnerships between direct lending and syndicated lending to be the best of both worlds. But essentially, you're looking at facts and circumstances at the time that you're signing the deal, right? So there may be things that drive you towards the direct lending market. For example, you don't want a long rating agency process. You don't want lender meetings. You, for some reason, the story is just harder to understand. It may guide you towards direct lending. If you need a really long commitment period and you're worried about market volatility, again, may lead you to the direct lending market. Also, the feedback that you're getting from your advisors, right? So your advisors may be saying, you know, this circumstance, I can deliver you a really great outcome for an LBO because the market's hot. It's a short time period. We've already pre-syndicated to a number of lenders versus the alternative, which is looking at how do these two deals stack up with one another, right? And I think that the best case scenario for a syndicated deal is going to be it's cheaper than a direct lending deal. There's going to be opportunities for them to be a more cost effective, right? Direct lenders are going to say, here, I can tell you exactly what your deal looks like, and I'm ready to work on that deal. And you don't have to worry about what the market does in the meantime. You don't need to worry about flex. And then again, the syndicated deal, if that's fully flexed, it's going to be more expensive than the direct lending deal. So it's almost just hedging your bets and figuring out which fits the bill for that scenario.
When it comes to covenant trends, how do these differ between the two markets right now?
I would say that direct lenders oftentimes have a little bit more religion on the debt terms that they will agree to. They are a little bit more focused on the words on the page of what the blockers say and what flexibility there is in the document, right? Because they are taking that document and they are living under it for years, as opposed to the banks who are offloading it into the syndicated market, right? And they may have a revolver position. They may continue to be involved as the agent or an arranger, but a lot of that risk is actually offloaded to the market. So they're more reliant on what will the market bear, right? For the direct lending folks, since they're holding it, they're the market. They can decide what they'll do or not do. And the real question is how much competition is there between other direct lenders who are willing to do the same thing. So what I would say is that LMEs have been happening on private credit deals, right? And they continue to happen on private credit deals. I would say more of them are happening behind the scenes, and less of them have to do with playing different lender groups off of each other, right? Because you have repeat players, you have people who have done, you know, their last five deals together, and they may be in the majority in one deal, minority in the other deal, and they're really kind of linking arms to work with the sponsor, work with the company, come up with a consensual solution versus, you know, some of the larger high profile LMEs, which are in the syndicated market, maybe a little bit more anonymity as to who's doing what to whom.
You've previously mentioned how co-op groups are increasingly forming well before a transaction is even on the table. When does it make sense to organize and when does it not?
I think it's going to be on a situation by situation basis. To my mind, when we're on the company side, we certainly would love to be able to transact with any lenders who want to come under the tent and get a deal done, right? And the co-op is going to be somewhat of an impediment to that, in that if it gets too large, then maybe I don't want to transact with you. But it also does provide a counterparty to talk to, right? So it's an organization. And there is someone who you could potentially negotiate with, come up with a deal plan, and then roll it out to a wider audience. I think that one thing we have seen, to your point, is these co-ops forming before the borrower and the sponsor were actually considering any LME options, right? So that's interesting when you have folks who maybe weren't considering LME who all of a sudden are, and they call up Weil and they say, hey, you know, this XYZ co-op group has formed. Like, what do you think they're after, right? And it's kind of interesting because then you pick up the docs, you have a chat about it, and you say, here's all the things you could do and what they're kind of protecting themselves from, but also what they know is kind of the market approach, right? Like LME is happening with enough frequency that people see it around the corner. That's why the co-op group is forming. And then they're willing to transact. There are co-op groups that are reaching out proactively to say, here's what we think is the best transaction for you and how we structure it and how we incentivize folks to participate in it and how it accomplishes your goals, right? Because at the end of the day, I think everyone wants to do deals, right? And either the LBO market is hot and there's a lot going on, or people are looking at their existing portfolio and figuring out, what am I missing here and what should I be doing, right? Am I overlooking the fact that there's a ton of discount that my debt is trading at? Am I overlooking the fact that the market for LME is busy enough that I could probably get some super senior money and I could kick out my maturities? And really, am I missing a piece of the puzzle? Why are my lenders organizing in a way that is counter to me and as a counterbalance to what I might do under documents, right? I think that regardless of what seat you are at the table, you know that these documents have a lot of flexibility in them. And it's more a matter of just gathering that flexibility and having a discussion about what makes the most sense in the circumstance. And I think that folks are willing to transact on those terms because they is a quid pro quo, as I referenced, get to tighten down their documents as well.
And we're seeing co-op blockers more often in new deals as well. Sometimes they flex out, sometimes they stick. Can you walk us through what's going on right now? What are you seeing?
I have seen a number of co-op blockers flexed out. I've also seen them killed at the grid stage. As of right now, I would say lenders are allergic to co-op blockers. And I think that the advice on the lender side is certainly that these are not to your benefit. But it goes back to my point about, you know, three times oversubscribed deals. Is there going to be a top tier sponsor who's able to push through some formulation of co-op blocker? I can't imagine that that's never going to be the case. From a borrower's perspective, that then, you know, widens the audience that you can speak with and maybe allows you to play people off of each other that may have otherwise been under a co-op. All of the folks that I've spoken to on the sponsor side of the equation are certainly very focused on this and looking proactively about, you know, the next wave of LME and the flexibility that lives under the document, the exceptions that they're negotiating and the impediments to it. So for example, co-ops are an impediment to LME in certain circumstances.
You also talked about deals where any lender holding over 20% has that excess stripped out for voting purposes. How common are these voting caps becoming right now?
I would say not super common. In my experience, it's kind of like a concentration limit in terms of voting. So what you're doing is essentially saying that you don't want lenders to buy up a big chunk of your debt and then be driving the train. I mean, if you're in a widely syndicated deal, it's already pretty spread out. So if you set that cap high enough, then it may never really come to fruition. But it does offer some protection from some large holder kind of, you know, taking advantage of their larger position.
How effective are they, like, in practice?
I haven't seen them play out in practice. It actually makes it, having worked on the lender side for years and years, it does make it difficult to calculate things. So if you're working for the agent and you're trying to figure out, okay, what is the hold of the various holders? How do I back out the overage? I think it may be more difficult than people are thinking it will be. It's interesting because you also have dissimilar voting rights in the European market, for example. So European market, there's a concept of snooze, you lose, right? So that means that if you don't respond to a request for an amendment, that you are taken out of the voting for that. In the U.S., we have not adopted that approach, and it's not something that has resonated with folks, notwithstanding some sponsors pushing for it. But I think that the voting technology is going to potentially drive different outcomes there, because if you think about it, there's probably plenty of times that people would not respond to an amendment request, but they wouldn't want to be deemed to have approved it or not voted based on not responding.
And I do want to finish off with your pipeline. What are some types of LMEs you're currently working on? Are you staying busy right now?
Certainly very busy, which is great. I think our approach at Weil is very much a not one size fits all approach. We're looking at the capital stack. We're looking at the stakeholders. We're looking at the pressure points and the flexibility in the documentation. And then we're setting forth a menu from least aggressive to most aggressive tactics, right? And all of it is a balancing act as to what you're trying to accomplish, how you drive those objectives, and then how you create the best process going forward. So in terms of governance, in terms of managing litigation risk, and in terms of incentivizing behavior from the various stakeholders that drives your outcomes. So we look at everything across the board in terms of what the optionality is. We look at all of the traditional, drop down, Perry Plus, up tier, double dip, but we certainly use those in combination. We come up with new strategies. We come up with new ways to accomplish, our objectives, and we look forward to continuing to innovate. Weil has always been an innovator in the space, and we're certainly not looking to give that up anytime soon.
Well, let's see how the market unfolds and what the rest of the year brings. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Justin, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure was all mine. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you to our listeners for checking out this episode of Debt Wired. As always, you can subscribe or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at DebtWired.com. See you next time.